the budget surplus.
I am.
Just going to let you know.
Okay.
Sure.
And so you're hearing this.
Much better than this. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order, and a quorum is present.
Okay, sure.
We're going to start with Senator Dibble's bill sent file 2092. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, I'm not sure if we have a written amendment or not. I do need to make an amendment to the bill. Just to change the effective date.
You can just read it to us. Senator, it's in the packets, I guess. The A1 amendment in the packets, just a change of the date. That's what?
Yeah. So, members.
Senator Dibble moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape he'd like to present it.
I do so move.
Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 2092 is a bill that pertains to low-income electric energy customers that are in the Xcel service territory. So Xcel customers in its Xcel program. And these are dollars that are paid by all ratepayers. I'm not sure how much, but just, you know, we all, as Xcel customers, pay into this program. And what it does is provides for a discounted electricity rate for low-income customers. And it also helps some low-income utility customers with paying their bills, and is targeted to those folks who are paying more than 3% of their monthly income on their electric bill. And then also it has an element to it that helps folks catch up on their bills if they're behind on their bill. It allows them to pay towards their arrearage. Xcel then assists with that and then keeps them on that so long as they stay current on their bill. The problem that has cropped up is that one side of the equation is absorbing a lot of the dollars and not letting and not supporting the targeted program to the extent that it needs to. So what this bill seeks to do is, rather than provide a discounted rate that kind of floats up and down, it kind of makes it a set amount per month, and then it also makes some changes into how the Power On, which is the kind of the targeted assistance program that I described, allows some changes to the Power On program. So that's what it seeks to accomplish. It's important to note that these programs are administered for less than 5% of the total level of funding. I know folks are interested in that subject these days. It creates more certainty for both programs. It costs no additional money to ratepayers, unless, of course, rates were to increase at some point in the future. That, of course, would make sense because then electricity would become less affordable to these low-income folks. Xcel is in support of these changes. I don't know if they intend to come to the table and indicate that for themselves, but that is my understanding. And I have Pam Marshall here who can help us understand the technicalities of how this bill is designed to work.
Ms. Marshall, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Pam Marshall with the Energy Sense Coalition. We administer the targeted portion of the funding that's available through this program. It's called the Power On program, and it limits the amount of income that customers devote to their electric costs to no more than 3%. And as Senator Dibble indicated, this pot of money was intended to support both the Power On program and the low-income discount program, but because the number of energy assistance households have increased, the amount of money that's going to the low-income discount is now taking up the vast majority of the funds. There's about $8.1 million available, and with this change, the Power On program would have a dedicated about $2.2 million, which would allow us to enroll about 2,600 additional Xcel Electric customers. I think just the last thing I wanted to add is that Power On is the most effective program for ensuring that low-income customers stay connected to their electric utility service. As long as they make their affordable payment, regardless if they're past due, because of that arrearage forgiveness component of the program, they remain connected to service. And in your packets, you have an information sheet that shows that about half of all of the Power On customers live at incomes between 0 and 75% of the federal poverty level. So this program is targeted at the very lowest income customers. And again, Xcel supports these changes as well and recognizes the importance of that program. And Mr. Chair, that's all I have. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. And I know we have Mr. Boland here from Xcel. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pat Boland from Xcel Energy. I manage our customer policy and compliance areas. I don't have any prepared comments other than to echo what Ms. Marshall and Senator Dibble have said, and Xcel does support the changes to this bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Is there anyone in the audience who wish to speak with concerns about the bill? If not, Senator Dibble moves Senate file 2092 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there a discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next one, Senator Dahl, is he around? He's not here. Will he be here in a minute or a few minutes? Should we take the next bill? Maybe I'll take my bill quickly because I think it's a quick bill. Senator Hoffman?
Yep, I will. For your support.
Yeah.
Oh, I was good.
Mr. Chair, Senate file 2206 is an agency bill. Department of Commerce energy bill. It's a cleanup. It's technical changes, and I'll just quickly go through the bill. Section 1 is updating, correct an error in the date of a bill passed last year from 2015 to 2017. Sections 2 and 3 are updates, changes in the PACE bill. That's the bill where local governments could loan money from the cities could loan money to businesses that were putting in alternative energy sources. They could, the one on top of page 2, you can see changing 10 to 20% of the assessed value so they can do bigger projects. And the second, section 3, simply allows alternative funding sources instead of revenue bonds. They could use, some cities have cash or GO bonds they'd like to use in that. Section 4 is simply repealer of obsolete rules, and we do have an amendment to the bill which changes a couple of those things, and I don't know if the amendment's in the packets or not.
Senator Marty, we're just, Mr. Fuller had mentioned that there it is, and I thought as Barb would have had that. I don't see, members of the packet, I don't see that it's in the packet.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we have Mr. Grant or Commissioner Rothman if they wanted to say some things about it.
Thank you.
Just quickly, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rothman.
And committee members, you know, this is department's bill this year. There's some critical things, obviously, with and the importance of energy efficiency and renewable energy. They're very important topics to all of us that to be able to turn the corner to improve it, places where we can in the state and to be leaders and continue our leadership. One of the I just want to highlight this in this bill. One of the key provisions we think that would be good to improve on is the PACE program and the PACE financing to allow municipalities to take advantage of alternative ways of financing and to increase the size of the projects that would be allowed under the PACE program. And so what you've seen here is, as Senator Marty has indicated, is that we're increasing the size from 10 to 20%, and as well offering or allowing alternative means other than the traditional financing that's been available through this program. Very pleased to see the legislation go forward and to do what we can, of course, to keep working on improving our programs in this area and to do more every time. And Commissioner Grant is here as well to go through any more details and to present basically if there's more details or information you want about the PACE program or anything like that.
Thank you, Mr. Rothman. Are there any questions from members? Senator Rosen and then Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Murray, it might be just a good idea to just briefly go over the PACE program again and how it works.
Senator Marty, Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rosen and members, PACE is the Property Assessed Clean Energy Program. It allows property owners to borrow money from newly established municipal financing districts to finance energy efficiency and renewable energy retrofits, and then to repay those loans through an annual special tax on their property bill. So that's the financing mechanism that we're talking about here. What the changes that we're proposing do in Section 2, it allows the limit on what the value of the improvement would be to increase a value of the improvement relative to the property value to increase from 10 to 20%. In this way, allowing more projects to qualify for financing under PACE. And in Section 3, this is to allow communities to use other than just revenue bonds, which is the current mechanism that was allowed. This would expand financing opportunities if communities had cash on hand or other means of financing these retrofits, they could use them through this mechanism. So those are the relevant provisions that we're seeking to change.
Thank you, Commissioner Grant. Senator Rosen, do you have a follow-up?
Nope.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and either Senator Marty, Mr. Grant, or Commissioner Grant, or Commissioner Rothman, I'm concerned about the 10 to 20% of assessed value that ends up being a large chunk of debt being owed, paying back through property taxes. And if someone were to default on a property with this sort of property tax assessment, where does this rank compared to repayment of mortgage, and how do mortgagors feel about this?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Benson, first of all, the reason that we've decided to go from 10 to 20% is that this is the feedback that we've gotten from those communities that are trying to utilize PACE as a financing mechanism, that they're running into too many instances where the 10% limitation was preventing those projects from moving forward. I will check, but my understanding is that this is in second place after repayment of the mortgage. So this is subordinate to the mortgage itself.
Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, it's just my concern that if a home only has, 2% equity and could not otherwise get a loan, now we're putting a 20% value. So it looks like Senator Marty has some additional.
Thank you, Senator Benson.
Senator Marty. Senator Benson, this was actually envisioned for often being used for residential property, but because of Fannie and Freddie and their prioritization, can't be used for that. But this is going to be used for commercial and industrial situations. And in other words, it's being done. It's not being used for residential ones because the risks to the cities would be there without that.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Sister Commissioner Grant, what are some of the projects, some of the renewable grant projects that have...
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, I can certainly get you a list of projects that are under discussion now in the various communities that have looked at this. I'd be happy to provide you with that information.
Some of the cities.
Thank you, Commissioner Grant. Senator Rosen?
Nope.
I keep sorry
maybe
about that.
Maybe.
Members, Senator Marty has in front of you the A1 amendment. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, this is a technical amendment. It basically, we were repealing the wrong obsolete rule. It's not obsolete, the one we were repealing. So it's changing the number in subdivision 3, and it's adding cost-weighted average on line 2.1. It's basically a technical change because this is a technical bill, and I think it accomplishes that.
Members, in front of you is the A2 amendment. Senator Marty moves the A2 amendment be accepted. A1. I stand corrected. It's the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right. Opposed, nay. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, let me ask Mr. Grant to go ahead for one concern.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the amendment seeking to are we on the?
I was going to say I haven't offered this, and I didn't know where it was from. So if you could speak to.
Oh, certainly, Mr. Chair and members, we've had advice that it would be good if the Section 2 and 3 provisions could be effective date of enactment rather than the normal August date, because we have projects in process now that could be held up if we're not able to make this effective date of enactment.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Grant.
I'll offer an oral amendment to, if Senate Council can give the wording, to make Sections 2 and 3 effective day filing final enactment.
Members, an oral amendment is in front of you. It's 3 and 4. Is that
2 correct? And 3. Sections 2 and 3 would be effective day following final enactment.
Senator Marty, I think Mr. Fuller has a
preciseness
on this.
Senator Marty, we add a section 1. So are you referring to the section on 1.23 and the section on 1.2.11? Are those the two sections?
No, it'd be sections of the bill, the sections 2 and 3 of the bill.
As drafted, not
okay.
amended.
So we'll just correct the references as an instruction. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Oral amendment is in front of the members. Senator Brown.
It's just Senator Marty, I have a question on the A1 amendment. It looks like we would extend the lease purchase agreements from 15 years to 25 years. Is that, am I looking at the right amendment?
Senator Marty, Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, this is a conforming amendment. In every other place where we've made changes to the PACE program, we've gone from 15 to 25 years. We didn't pick up this one other reference last year when we were making those changes. So this is a conforming amendment.
Senator Brown.
And Commissioner Grant, my question is, what kind of lease purchase agreement, what type of equipment would this be for?
Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, typically in a commercial building, this will be on heating, ventilating, air conditioning equipment, efficiency improvement retrofits. It could also be a renewable energy system, if that's what a solar system or what have you, if that's what the commercial customer was intending to install.
And, Senator Brown?
Mr. Chair, and what is the actual lifespan of this equipment? Would it even be functioning in 25 years?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, yes. These are long-lived equipment changes, usually lasting at least 25 years.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I know one of nonprofit in my former district, Senator Scalzi's district, put in a ground source heat pump. It was like $500,000 investment about 15 years ago. It was pre-PACE program, but yes, it's actually paid for itself already, and it's supposed to last 30, 40, 50 years. I think they warranty it for at least 30 years. But
Senator Brown?
Mr. Chair, and Senator Marty, I understand that. My concern would be more if this was used for solar or wind, where that technology is changing fairly rapidly, where in 15 years they're stuck with a 25-year deal when they could go with newer technology that's going to save even more money. So I guess that's a concern of mine, and maybe that's not a good concern. But
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, it's if you invest in a, if a business would invest in a less effective means of doing something that they could save more money if they waited a few years, yes, they could have saved more money if they waited a few years. But if it's something that they're going to get a payback on it now, and they choose to do it, yes, they'll keep paying for it, but they'll keep getting the power from the device as well. So it's still in their interest to do it. If you could know that there'd be some great new technological or cost-saving advancement in 5 years, you might choose to wait 5 years, but they'll still be better off than they are without doing it. But your point is correct. If a new technology or better product comes available, that's always the gamble on whether you invest in something now or later.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Senator Brown. Senator Marty, you have one more testifier, Jeremy Kalin. I saw him. Oh, there he is. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeremy Kalin, K-A-L-I-N. I'm the president of Eutectics Consulting. We're a mission-oriented for-profit company headquartered in Minneapolis. We facilitate financing for building-scale energy improvements, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate File 2206, particularly the PACE provisions. When I served in the legislature, I was actually fortunate enough to be the chief author in the House of the enabling legislation for the PACE program. And it's important to know just a little bit of background about PACE. What we did is we actually just took the existing special assessment law under Section 429.101 that has been used to finance voluntary improvements to property, whether it's tree trimming or sewer and water lines, or actually in the case of the skyways in downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul, and anywhere else in the state where there are skyways, those are enabled before the 2010 statute change to use these voluntary special assessments on the property as security funded by private dollars through the purchase of a revenue bond. So PACE loans are a special assessment. It's actually a senior lien that is senior to the mortgage for commercial industrial properties, but it is entirely funded by private capital. And it is voluntary, so it's a petition for an assessment by that parcel owner. The PACE serves as a credit enhancement that's really important for several projects. At Eutectics, we were the first in the country to actually facilitate, and I believe you have the in your packet a case study from the SALU project in Edina. The city of Edina started a pilot project to be the first PACE community in the state. And the SALU restaurant wanted to upgrade their lights to LED lighting and put in some mechanical controls, all for efficiency, all for energy savings projects, but could not find financing for it. So PACE made a project that would not otherwise have helped reduce operating costs possible. And Bremer Bank was the first community bank in the country to be the funder of a project.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kalin. Did you have... Do you want to continue? We have a question from one of the senators here.
Mr. Chair, to give a tiny little bit more background to answer a couple more questions.
Yep.
The extension from 10 to 20% in Section 2 as introduced is actually in response to projects that our company and others have been developing where that 10% cap, including the first solar project of its kind in Minneapolis that should be approved this month, where that 10% cap has truly been an issue. But because the lien is senior to the mortgages, we've actually had to get sign-off on the existing mortgage holders. It's not a market barrier because we're batting 100% of the projects we've developed. But currently, the cities of Minneapolis, Edina, Egan, Eden Prairie, Cottage Grove, and then Southwest Minnesota Region 9 are all have active PACE programs through the St. Paul Port Authority or their own. So it's a rapidly expanding tool. We're sort of at the end of proof of concept. And I'll just say, Mr. Chair, if I could, that what we have seen is that the success of PACE is because it's a very conservative, market-oriented, privately financed tool that is entirely in line with all the other assessment vehicles and funding streams that we've used before. In working with the department over the last couple of years to look at the market and look at the barriers, we have urged a very conservative and cautious approach, including continuing to involve those mortgage lenders
Since we are helping to improve their property, they should know the benefits of the property and make sure it's consistent with the terms of that mortgage.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Kalin. Senator Asmik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, just I'm trying to understand maybe a little bit more about this program. So correct me if I'm wrong. What this program does is it creates the mechanism by which individual private owners can go through their local jurisdictions if they participate in this program to have a loan and then pay it back through their ad valorem taxes, correct?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, this is correct.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Asmik.
Why wouldn't we just have them go through the private market, get a home equity loan and do or a business loan and do this themselves?
Senator Marty.
I'll let Mr. Kalin speak to that.
Mr. Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Asmik. That's a great question. And PACE is just a tool where a direct loan between the capital source and the borrower on the commercial industrial side is there's not enough cap. There's not enough basically, there needs to be a small credit enhancement or other means to achieve the public good. So we've done this on, for instance, on roads and sidewalks. We do it on a district level. Here it's a voluntary petition that we've done for sewer and water connections. We've done for tree trimming and other improvements to private property. We're merely adding energy efficiency and renewable energy, or we have, I should say, to that. And so it's truly just a credit enhancement that makes possible these deeper projects. And what we've seen is not only is it helping make projects that wouldn't otherwise be completed possible, especially energy savings projects, frequently it's actually increasing the scope of deferred maintenance and mechanical issues that are being addressed by building owners, including the just a 10-second picture of the first energy efficiency project that's been approved by the Port Authority. The City of Minneapolis just has to formally enroll it this month. $120,000 original scope of work on a 25-year-old building. They've wanted to go deeper and get ready to re-up their lease with a major tenant in 2016. So they ended up actually being able to take care of all of their issues on a zero-down, cash flow-positive basis because PACE financing made it happen.
Thank you. Senator Asmik, follow-up. I see that Commissioner Grant came to the table, too. Do you want it? No? Nope. All right. Senator Asmik.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So by credit, or what you're saying is that the interest or the amount of costs that are incurred by the property owner is going to be lower as a result of this and creating the incentive? Or I guess I'm still trying to wrap my head around why wouldn't you just go to U.S. Bank, for lack of a better organization, to simply get the same $100,000 that you would get through this type of a program and keep the state out of the completely out of the situation?
Mr. Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Asmik, it's precisely when there is either challenged credit for a small business or that the length of term, what we can do is we can buy down interest rates just by having the special assessment. I just want to be clear, there's no incentive. There is zero incentive. In fact, the cost of running the program by statute in 216C, 435 or 436, I think it's 436, require that that there be an additional charge, and the Port Authority is charging an additional 50 points, 0.5%. Bond sale at 5%, add the 50 points, so it's 5.5 for the borrower. So the private borrower is paying all the costs of the program. And because there's this senior lien, we've done this exactly the same thing. We do it all the time on transportation projects for access to roads. We do it all the time for sewer and water and skyways, et cetera. So it truly is a privately financed credit enhancement when the direct loan to the borrower either is going to be too expensive or they can't do long enough term. And we've been able to make it really work. My job is to make the money flow in a private money flow to private borrowers. And when we can do that directly, fantastic. When we can't, this tool is a really helpful tool.
Thank you, Mr. Kalin. Follow-up, Senator
yes,
Asmik?
Mr. Chair, a couple other questions on this.
When and then we go to Senator Dibble.
The cost, there's going to be a cost for administrative purposes through the local jurisdiction that takes place in this. Is that embedded in the charges? And the other component is, and then I'll finish asking questions, is if this is part of a person's taxes and they're going to be paying it each year on their tax bill, if the person defaults or is foreclosed upon, regular assessments become due on property change. Is that meaning that this loan also then would be due or repayment is going to have to be performed on this prior to this property changing hands to a new owner?
Mr. Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Asmik, great questions. The first is to your answer about all costs being paid for out of the statute requires it. So yes. And then second, like every other special assessment, it has to be disclosed upon sale or foreclosure, and it has to be openly negotiated. What we have learned is that in the commercial market, 99.9, I don't know what the exact number is, more than 99% of all assessments are paid off on sale. And so, this is why we do work with the existing note holders to make sure that they're comfortable with it, with a strong loan-to-value ratio, savings exceeding repayments, et cetera.
Oh, thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I think Senator Osmick got to the nub of the why, which is sometimes the terms aren't available to commercial industrial borrowers in terms of length of repayment. The interest rate is lower than the typical capital markets, and you're able to cities, municipalities, or these development authorities can kind of aggregate. You know, that's you know, they have access to lower interest rates. You can aggregate some of these projects all together, so it creates an opportunity in the marketplace where there isn't one in the typical private capital markets. But you hit the nail on the head.
Thank
you. Kalen explained himself well.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill as amended be recommended pass.
Senator Marty has. Oh, Senator Brown.
Just quick question: will this bill be going to state and local government?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I think it's going directly to the floor. I don't think they've asked for it. This is simply technical changes in existing programs. We're not adding any new programs or anything that would affect state and local government, and they have not requested it.
Okay. Correct.
Thank you. Senator Marty's motion is in front of us. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Senator Marty, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Senator Dahl, Senate File 2164, Residential Propane Customer Sale and Service Terms and the Discontinuance of Service During the Heating Season Regulations. Senator Dahl, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's good to be in front of this committee again. I have three bills up in this time frame, so I just got done across the hall, and I have another one up soon, but if I get up and leave, it's nothing that anyone said. Hopefully we can have an efficient time here in the next 10, 15 minutes or so. This is Senate File 2164, and if I could just give maybe a very brief overview, and then I could maybe walk through the bill with you, and then I do have some testifiers that can probably answer questions even better than I can.
Senator Dahl? I understand that you have an amendment that you want to add. You want to present that first, or?
Yes, the A4 amendment, Mr. Chair.
And that is a delete all amendment? Members, it should be in front of you. No, it's not. Passing it out now. There we go. Senator Dahl, while this is being passed out, do you want to give
sure.
us some background?
Yeah, provisions in this bill are based on consumer protections that apply to all other utilities in current Minnesota statute, including rural electric co-ops and municipal utilities. And some provisions are also based on other states' regulations, such as Connecticut, Maine, New Mexico, Vermont. This bill does not attempt to regulate propane prices. It does require that each propane distributor report those prices to the department, and it limits some of the fees that they can charge. The bill does not attempt to cap the prices or profit margins of propane companies. What it does is to prohibit vendors from charging unreasonable non-fuel-related fees, including fees if a customer does not use enough propane.
Senator Dahl, I just wanted to – members, the delete all is in front of you. Senator Marty moves the delete all amendment. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Senator Dahl.
Yes, and this bill primarily pertains only to those that take in LIHEAP dollars, receive over $200,000 in LIHEAP funds. We know Last year, propane companies received nearly $10 million in federal low-income home energy assistance programs. And then in, as of February 28th this year, the industry had received over $11 million in LIHEAP funds. So obviously, as we've heard, propane supply constraints are likely to continue. In that case, higher prices are also anticipated. Low and fixed income households must be given the opportunity to enter into budget agreements, make payment arrangements in order to afford the higher prices that they're seeing. Customers whose monthly income is less than the cost of a propane delivery should not be refused delivery if they agree to pay for the fuel over time. In the propane industry, if it was truly competitive, there may be less of a need for consumer protections, but the industry is consolidated significantly, and customers cannot shop for alternative suppliers in some instances because the majority lease their tanks, and only the company that rents you the tank can fill the tank with propane. So it's really a consumer protection bill. Again, not necessarily going at the mom and pop propane dealers. We just want to make sure that there's some protections in place for this important heat source. I guess I can go through the bill very quickly with you, and if you have questions along the way, and then I'll turn
Senator
it over.
Senator Brown has a question for you.
Okay. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dahl, I appreciate your doing that. Could you point out the differences on your delete all versus the bill as it was introduced? I mean, as you're going through the bill, you were going to highlight what's in the delete all. I looked at the bill as it introduced. I'd like to know how this delete all is significantly different from the original.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Brown. We'll try to do that. It's been a work in progress, and some of these things just came to me just before I came in here today as well. But we'll try as best we can to highlight some of those differences. The first section, of course, is just definitions, and you'll be seeing throughout the particular bill. And if I get to a spot that's different, let me know. Section 2, a price and fee disclosure. A propane distributor must...
Senator Dahl, yep. Sorry. Senator, didn't mean to cut you, Senator. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, I did notice you changed the size of the propane distributors from 100 to a 200,000.
Yes.
Yeah. Just wanted to make...
Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Senator Marty. That is one of the changes and actually keeps some of the more local distributors out of the loop on that. And so thanks for highlighting that. Section 2, price and fee disclosure. Again, a propane distributor must prepare a document listing current per gallon price of propane and additional charges fees made available upon request and posted. Budget payment plan, Section 3. A propane distributor must offer a reasonable effective budget plan to a customer whose payments for residential heating services are current, who's entered into and is complying with the contract with the distributor for residential service. And, again, we're just trying to make sure that that's being done uniformly throughout for all of the people that are receiving propane. Delinquent account or payment agreement. A propane distributor must offer a reasonable payment agreement to a low-income customer whose account is delinquent, and then there's some factors that would constitute a reasonable payment agreement in that particular regard. The service discontinuance, again, that's a new change, and is that, uniform with the cold weather rule, I believe. So that is a new section and consistent with the cold weather rule we already have in place for other utilities. So, I won't go into the specifics on that. If you have questions, let me know. The non-discrimination, just because you offer particular payment plans to one, want to make sure that you offer those to all customers, not just newer customers or specific customers. Some terms of sale. There's some things here regarding minimum delivery. I guess as we look at this, I'll give you an example of why this particular thing is needed for the minimum delivery. A Northern Star Co-op Cenex dealer requires customers with a 500-gallon tank that uses less than 400 gallons per year to pay an additional $75 a year, or any customer with a 1,000-gallon tank that uses 800 to 1,000 gallons will be charged $150 a year, and if a customer uses less than 800 gallons, they're charged $200 per year. So this is getting to that particular practice that's going on out there. Certain sales cannot be refused in terms of receiving LIHEAP funds. Page 5 on the A4, subdivision 3, can't charge additional fees for delivery charge, except when the customer requests a delivery to be made outside of the propane distributor's normal business hours, or if it's same-day or emergency delivery service. No propane distributor may charge an additional fee to a residential customer for metered gas minimum usage or minimum volume requirements. And if you need more specifics on that, Ms. Marshall can answer that. Information about LIHEAP must be given. Also, some other security issues related to third-party disclosure or deposits. Is the registration reporting new? That is to
There's
the commissioner.
Some
language here about reporting, registering with the commissioner, and reporting as well. And the moving on here, the enforcement position, is that in which section? Excuse me. In the last, the very end? Oh, in the very last page. The Commissioner of Commerce may enforce this section using any of the authority granted to the Commissioner, Section 45. So that was a very quick overview. Perhaps if you have specific questions now or maybe after we hear from Pam Marshall. I think also we have another testifier or two that also could maybe shed some light on some of the specifics.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. I have Commissioner Rothman, Pam Marshall, Roger Leiter, I hope I said that right, and then Court Holton in on that list. So do you want to go ahead and start? John Fuller? Senator Brown.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dahl, just a quick question. Is it your intent to move this bill as amended to the Commerce Committee after this committee?
Yes.
Senator Brown, Dahl. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. They have asked for the bill.
Thank you.
And I know the reason why you're asking, and I appreciate that. I know that we have received some amendment language, perhaps, from the propane dealers themselves, which we received about a half hour ago. And there's a possibility that we'll still continue to work on this bill and appreciate any input that they want to give on this. And we'll have time to look that over. So I don't know how finally you like bills that leave this committee, but Commerce will be taking another look, and perhaps we can agree to some of their suggestions.
Thank you.
Senator Brown, thank you. Senator Asmik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the previous version, subsection 7 or subdivision 7 had a physician certificate. Did that get moved any place within this? I couldn't find it in the amended version. Has that been deleted or has that been moved someplace?
Senator Dahl, Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Asmik, that part has been deleted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. Do you want to start with Ms. Marshall? Is that?
Sure.
All right. Thank you. Welcome back on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Pam Marshall with the Energy Sense Coalition. I want to refer to a number of the handouts that were included in your packets in order to talk about the need for some of the provisions in the bill. I'll be asking you to look at those. One of those handouts is titled the Propane Fact Sheet. That fact sheet shows that about 214,000 Minnesotans heat their homes with propane. Under the current prices, one quarter of those households are spending an extraordinary amount of income for propane. That is the number of customers who are income eligible for the energy assistance program. That same page shows how much the prices have increased over a more typical winter and over last year's warmer winter prices. At these prices, it is nearly impossible for low and fixed income customers to pay the full cost of propane delivery all at one time. This information illustrates why there are budget payment plan and payment arrangement sections included in the bill. Propane dealers offer these terms to some customers, but not to those who are past due or who can't pass a credit check. In effect, they don't allow the customers who actually need these terms the most from spreading out the cost of fuel that they have to buy to heat their homes. Another way to illustrate this hardship is included in the handout titled Sample Propane Orders. The information on that sheet shows that the percentage of monthly income that the average energy assistance customer devotes to purchase various amounts of propane, both with and without additional non-fuel fees, is staggering. If you need a 400-gallon propane delivery in a given month and you're paying the lowest of the current prices available, the delivery would require you to pay 65% of your monthly income. At the high price indicated on that sheet, nearly 100% of your total monthly income would be required to purchase 400 gallons of propane. And this is a price well below the highest price that customers have experienced this winter. I offer this information about price not to make a case for propane price regulation, but simply to urge you to allow propane customers to enter budget payment plans and payment arrangements. Those are the sections 3 and 4 in the bill. If you could also refer in the handouts to the Feral Gas Master Agreement, you will see in the middle of the page that offering such time payment plans is not a standard industry practice. It's important to note that we are not, as Senator Dahl indicated, requiring these terms of all propane customers, but only those that receive a significant amount of public funds in the form of the Energy Assistance Program. Given that level of public subsidy, our position is that we believe some measures are necessary to protect the public. One of those measures is Section 5 in the bill. That's probably the one that's changed the most between the original version and the amendment. That is modeled on our cold weather rule statute that exists for rural electric cooperatives and municipal utilities. Extending coverage to propane customers is consistent with that law. Effectively, propane companies operate under similar monopolistic terms than our utilities with assigned service territories. If you look in your packet under the propane industry information sheet, you can see what I mean. The vast majority of customers lease their propane tanks. The propane company that rents you a tank is the only company that can fill the tank. The only real customer choice available to propane customers is really no choice at all, because the cost to purchase your own tank is about $1,500. By way of contrast, most propane companies lease their tanks for between $10 and $50 a year. In this case, then, the propane company is the monopoly provider, just as a utility or cooperative is the monopoly provider of either natural gas or electric service. Even if you do own your own tank, and even if you you can pay the costs that are involved to switch suppliers, their terms of service are so similar that it wouldn't matter much anyway. Most of the companies charge very similar fees for a variety of non-fuel related costs. For example, you can be charged if you request a minimal amount of fuel. And since low-income people are the ones that are most likely to request smaller amounts of fuel because that's all they can afford, they're also the most likely to have the additional fees added on. Section 7 of the bill is the section that lowers the amount of those fees that are associated with minimal deliveries. Companies also charge fees if you do not use enough propane, a level that is set by them. This bill prohibits that practice and the charging of fees for those minimum amounts. Other provisions in Section 7 that are important consumer protections include security deposits and requiring propane companies to accept cash payments. Again, if you refer to the Feral Gas Master Agreement, you'll see why this language is necessary. That company's contract states that they require a customer to pay a service deposit in an amount determined by them from time to time. They also decide whether or not they will accept cash payments. But the contract language isn't the only reason that these protections are in place in this bill. They're also in place because of industry practice, particularly the discrimination clause. An owner of a mobile home park called me. He couldn't be here today to testify, but he did send me an email, and he was aware of a couple that purchased a home in his park, and the parents of the couple went to the local dealer to buy to rent their tank and to buy their first fill of propane, but they were told that they wouldn't be served because they lived in the trailer park. He also became aware of about four or five other similar situations. One person ended up buying a wood pellet stove, getting through one winter, and then leaving. Another tenant in the park switched, who was financially able to do so, switched to an electric furnace. And one woman in the park used her electric kitchen stove for an entire heating season and got an energy assistance grant from the program in her area because they determined that electricity was her primary fuel source. He also told me that two owners in the park have lost prospective buyers because it's so difficult, if not impossible, to secure propane service. He has about four units currently that are empty because no one in that the one dealer in town will not deliver to that park. Energy Sense also supports the reporting provisions in this bill. You have a price survey that's included in your packet. Unfortunately, not all the propane distributors are reporting their prices, which is why you don't see the $6.67 a gallon, which was the highest price that people have reported to the department and other agencies. Those provisions shed some light on an industry, and I think the only way to help protect consumers is to if that information is more publicly available. Finally, Mr. Chair and members, this is an industry that is consolidating, achieving, in the words of one of the companies themselves, margin and cash flow growth despite increases in underlying cost of propane. They hold all of the power in the relationship between the consumer and the company. And I believe these provisions are justified and long overdue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I would have a little different perspective than you have. I grew up in rural, and when my father was upset at one point with our propane distributor, we switched to a different propane distributor. So that's not truly monopolistic. If he was upset with our electric company, we had no choice. We couldn't switch. But I remember my father was upset with the propane distributor, and we did switch. So that's not monopolistic. There was a choice that we had with our propane supplier. So I would disagree with your assessment of what you said in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Did you want to respond, Ms. Marshall, or should we go to Commissioner Rothman?
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'm wondering if you had to purchase your tank in order to make that switch and what the costs were involved for pumping the tank out, removing the tank, and resetting the new tank from the new supplier. And my point, I guess, was that barrier to buying that tank and paying all of those associated costs is something that low and fixed income people cannot afford to do. And once the tank is set, that supplier is the only one that can fill it.
Thank you. Commissioner Rothman, welcome back.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and I have general comments to the whole bill, and I can answer, perhaps put an additional information on the question that was put to us as well. So that's either way, it's fine with me.
Absolutely. Commissioner, welcome. Go ahead and let's hear what you got. This
All right.
is good.
Sounds good. First, before I forget into that point, I think it's imperative that people do understand that, if you are to switch, there are some limitations on your ability to do that. One is the cost of doing that. Number two, it's making sure that the liabilities line up. And then, obviously, there are those opportunities. Let me speak, though, to the larger issue and concerns from the Department of Commerce, and as well to provide some information to the committee about the recent propane crisis and why it's imperative to why these are important provisions. And I want to upfront thank Senator Dahl for bringing forth these to Pam Marshall and the folks in the Energy Sense community, and as well as being open to additional comments and suggestions from the department on adding some provisions to help here as well. Let me first say and pick up where Ms. Marshall had indicated, there are well over 200,000 people, residents in Minnesota that use propane for home heating in their homes.
The propane supply and price crisis that we just experienced, and we're still actually in Minnesota, has been devastating. And it's been a very stressful situation, not only for residences, but also for small businesses. And it's been a strain on our energy supply in Minnesota. As all of you know, the governor did immediately take a bunch of steps in order to help both on the supply side, which also have some interest and concerns, to be able to help on the price side. The governor did declare, as you know, a peacetime emergency to be able to act quickly in order to help with the increased supply. The governor did meet with the propane industry, and first I do want to acknowledge that it's been a very productive and a good working relationship in order to address a lot of the big problems, both on the supply side and, as I'll talk about, on the individual consumer side. The second of all, I also want to acknowledge and stress the importance of the community action agencies, the local service providers around the state, 32 of them, including Lutheran Social Services, for their in essence, their heroic work in order to make sure that people received the assistance, the financial assistance, but also helped us triage some very difficult cases that we were dealing with. Most importantly, let me talk about the hotline that the governor and the Department of Commerce set up through the HSEM, the Homeland Security, under the Declaration of Emergency. The hotline was made available to anybody having problems with propane. We received well over 4,000 calls from individuals in desperate need. And let me break down those calls just in high level for you. We received at the peak hundreds of calls every day of concern for people who are flat out no propane, going into, as many of you know, bitterly cold sub-zero winter weekends. We just had one this last week. and so they, first of all, were calling. Half of them were calling, roughly half, were calling because they wanted access to low-income heating assistance program, so the LIHEAP program administered by the Department of Commerce and the local service providers. So we had staffing available all through that crisis period, and still do, to help people facilitate getting low-income heating assistance. There is also an additional 50%, or a little actually higher than the 50%, of people who are calling the hotline concerned and registering complaints about high prices, about delays, about fees, about not being able to fill their tanks on time, and for desperate assistance and from us. And we set up a triage system with our staff and as well with the local service providers, but also directly with the propane industry. And I spoke with Roger Leiter, and I want to acknowledge this, that when people were when they didn't qualify or were ineligible for low-income heating assistance, meaning they couldn't get funding from us, and they had issues with getting fills, and they didn't have the financial assistance, we worked with the propane distributors and retailers to make sure that those people had propane when they could. There are obviously some issues with respect to resolving some of those, but those are the issues. Because of that, it highlights the imperative of addressing some of the consumer protection issues that are highlighted and included in this bill. So again, they're important protections that need to be included. So from our perspective, making sure that offers these protections for the propane customers that heat their homes with propane, that they have the ability to have the pricing terms available to them. It clarifies that dealers cannot discriminate on the basis of a customer's ability to pay. It clarifies the terms of sale so that in terms of the partial fills and all of that, those were things we heard on the phone. People saying, we can't get a fill. We have to totally fill it to the top of the tank or we won't get any more. These are important protections to help people through these crisis times. And people who are already, you know, locked in with their current propane provider who may not have the ability to shop on the moment. And then I just want to highlight some of the additional language we're happy to see to add it to the bill as you have it today. It strengthens the consumer protection by providing clear language that would prohibit discriminatory practices at the point of delivery, and that's in Section 6. In Section 9 and 10, this allows we already have these notification provisions for other fuel sources. It allows the Department of Commerce to basically have a heads up well in advance of a supply crisis or problem from happening, so that we will receive notice when the products are not physically available for sale to licensed distributors. And then the last section, Section 11, adds to our what's already existing law, basically, and it's, from our perspective, just a simple clarification. The one thing that I did do in response under the directive, under the emergency, and in working with the governor, was to send out a letter to the propane industry saying we wanted to keep a very close eye on propane prices. At one point, prices hit $6.67 in some areas, which the typical price as some know, was about in October of last year, for example, is about $1.60, $1.70. And that's the average typical range. Well, when it hits a triple the amount of what it would be, either for low-income heating assistance people, but also for middle-income people or people who are just above that threshold. And I do have to say, even people who, that's three times what your normal fill is, and if it just hit people's budget at a very tough time. So in any event, it's imperative to have some of these protections in place, and we wanted to make sure that under the crisis, the governor and the administration responded not only to get supply up to Minnesota, which helps with the price supply, working with the propane industry, pipeline industry, working with the White House, working with the federal regulators, we were able to and have over a period of time bring down week by week the prices from 25 to 50 cents on a weekly basis to where they're still about double what they are, close to being double what they were in the marketplace. Still an issue for us. We're not out of the woods yet, but at the same time, feel that these are important enhancements that should be added to people to protect us as we go forward this next year.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner Chair. Rothman. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Rothman, in Section 7, it talks about minimum delivery charges, minimum usage, delivery, and flat-out delivery charges. You know, businesses pass on individual charges within their pricing structure for a reason, that they have costs incurred in doing business. Do we know what the net impact of excluding these types of charges are going to actually have to the segment or to the propane business in general? As in, you know, if they cannot recoup charges through some of these other mechanisms, is this not going to have a net effect, LIHEAP or no LIHEAP, across the entire propane business because of the exclusion of these charges? And do we have any idea what that impact may or may not be?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, first of all, I wouldn't want to speak for the propane industry or those companies, and they're here and perfectly willing to defer to them on the specifics. But let me give you a couple of instances and problems that have come to our attention. Again, going back to the hotline, we got a lot of calls from people saying we were being charged just when we have a contract in place, we had charges that we didn't know about, and in order to get our fills, when we were either out or low in their tanks, people were saying they're just being charged on top of the $6.67 or $5 and on top of the $4. So, you got to keep that into account during these price spikes. Second of all, even in a conversation yesterday with a farmer who had propane on his property for the use for the agriculture side, but also had a propane tank for the home, was going to be charged just to move the propane on his own property over to his house, and wondered why is that? Why is that? I pass that along to you as well. And then in particular, when you're in a low-income heating assistance, or when we're trying to get deliveries out to people, it becomes an inherent barrier to the safety and well-being of individuals. So we would just, you know, we just think it's important to take a look at that and be considerate of those consumer protections.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Osmick has a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, in follow-up to that question, and keep in mind, I don't necessarily say whether I agree or disagree with any of the charges or activities you're talking about, but these wouldn't be provisions within a contract that actually suddenly popped up out of thin air, that these would have been provisions that were originally written into documentation that the owner, that the property owner already agreed to previously, far prior to any kind of an emergency situation that might have come up with the propane industry. So wouldn't you agree that that would be somewhat of a buyer beware, be known what you've signed and be known what is coming forth, because these provisions could come in the case of an emergency. Isn't that true?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, you know, there was a lot of issues that came up with these prepaid contracts, which is what you're referring to. Not everyone is on a prepaid contract. So not every – in fact, I could find the statistics, or we could ask and do a request for that information. Many folks are on a cash-only basis. And for those, we did receive complaints for people who were on contracts who were being charged fees that they were not disclosed or that they were concerned about. So I just say be open to hearing all of the various issues that came up and to try to figure out the best solution to resolve them.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Osmick. Commissioner Rothman. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Rothman, are you working with the Attorney General Office on those places where contracts were violated by fees that weren't in contract?
Commissioner Rothman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, let me answer a couple ways. First of all, the Department of Commerce has already opened up and a lot of these complaints and taking a look at them and asking the propane companies for background information in terms of its own investigation and all of that. Second of all, the Attorney General staff have contacted our department for information about what we have learned in the crisis and the information that we have. And Mr. Chair, in the process of that communication, basically, in terms of where things are and what happened.
Okay. Hey, Commissioner. Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Rothman. You talked about some actions the governor has taken to help with supply. Are there specific actions that need to be taken that would stabilize our supply long-term? We're talking about some contract limitations here. There's some demand pieces being taken care of with some solar thermal activity that's already moved through this committee. On the supply side, are there specific things that we should be doing to stabilize our supply?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, yes. Absolutely. Let me preface this with some background. As we got into the crisis, ultimately we found pretty much three or four reasons for the supply shortfall. First of all, was the export of propane. It traditionally was at about a 5% export rate, and it went up to 20%, which is why you heard or saw part of the action activity was to call on the administration to stop the exporting. Because of that supply going out of the United States, it wasn't being delivered to Minnesota, the Midwest, nor the Northeastern region. Second of all, last winter's drying in the agriculture at the end of November put a it wasn't out of the ordinary. It wasn't we've had this much drain on the supply, but it wasn't expected this last winter, at least from the perspective of the propane industry. From the farming perspective, it was anticipated because there's a late harvest in May and therefore a late harvest period. But they didn't jive and became an issue. Second of all, or third, we had the cold snap, the within the last 30, 35 years, the coldest winter on record. And sub-zero days now well exceeding 40. I think we're at 43 or something like that, which through demand, I mean, just right through the roof. And at the vortex of all this, or the delta, whatever, the supply and demand just crashed, and that's why prices spiked in the pretty much unregulated industry. So let me just say that those dynamics need to be resolved. It's not that they may or may not happen again. but I also want to add and make this be informative. It's imperative that we have this conversation with all stakeholders in the propane industry, ag community, and with the committee members. Because part of what happened was that in December, the Cochin pipeline issue came up, and the governor, we called a meeting, and we had a discussion with the propane industry and other stakeholders. We also had a very good meeting with the similar folks in January, where the governor sat down and we talked about these immediate crisis issues, and then talked a little bit about the intermediate and long-range ones. Let me cut to the chase. Kinder Morgan, the company that is bringing down propane through the Cochin pipeline to Minnesota, has made the decision to not use that pipeline to deliver propane to Minnesota. It represents about 40% of Minnesota's propane supply, and that is a significant amount of propane this state will not be getting through the pipeline this as of April. And therefore will exacerbate the situation for next year. So long-term solutions are what I've said. Let me start. The answer is it should be all hands on deck. We need to find a way to solve that major supply delivery system. If it's not the pipeline, we have to look at rail. We have to look at trucks. We have to look at storage capacity issues on farms, on homes. We have to look at making sure people understand, going back to the prepaid contract conversation we just had, to prepay, take advantage of those, do what you can to be prepared for this coming winter. I was asked in the United States Senate Energy Subcommittee some questions about and presented on the propane issue. It's on the energy, the Senate side in any event, their radar screen about the supply. And was asked about a reserve, whether or not we should have a Midwest reserve similar to the Northeast home heating oil reserve to be able to. Now, there's a lot of issues with a reserve. There's where would you put it, capacity, price, cost, who pays, et cetera. All I'm saying is I think it's all of the above and any of the above, and I think the members of the committee, along with the House, the legislature, the governor, the industry, the stakeholders all need to be having this conversation so that we can prevent and mitigate for next year.
Thank you, Commissioner Rothman. Senator Benson, did you have another follow-up? Or Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly agree with what you just said, Commissioner, and we do need to be concerned about the long-term implications. I don't disagree that there are certain issues that have been outlined here that we also need to deal with. However, as we talk about the issue of long-term supply, the very people that we're trying to castigate as the villains here are the people that are going to have to help us deal with that issue. And I think that, you know, we can take a look at a variety of things, and we're going to have the pipeline issue is going to greatly affect how we handle putting in backup supplies and what have you. And quite frankly, at this point in time, if the state doesn't act to get rid of its warehouse tax, we're going to do nothing but add to the cost of those propane supplies for our users in this state. And so at this point, we are not being conducive to helping the problem. I think we need to talk about these issues that have been outlined here. I think we need to sit down with the industry, and these things need to be worked out. But I think that this bill in and of itself does nothing in terms of helping that long-term issue. And I think also, before I quit my remarks here, we should also remember
that many of the cold weather rules that have been developed for industries that are regulated, and that when the end of the heating season is here, they will automatically get their money. Where right now, when the end of the heating season is here, if there's a large balance outstanding and the customer is able to move, they can simply move, and if they should own the tanks and have another supplier and have an outstanding bill, that then the propane company has to go through the court system to get paid on. And I think that we are trying to compare apples to oranges, and it's much more complicated than that. And so,
thank you, Senator Weber. Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, I would agree. I would agree. I don't think you heard me say anything particularly negative necessarily, and not to villainize anybody. I want to make it from our perspective pretty straightforward. That we had a good and cordial dialogue, the governor and the Department of Commerce, with respect to, well, what caused this and what can we do to help each other? Asked, what's causing it? We found it was going out of the country. Well, then we acted to try to stop that. When it was, well, we should make some important phone calls to help with the pipeline, prioritizing the shipments to help the industry get those shipments here. We did what we could to facilitate each other in that conversation. I also would, in addition to what you said, want to acknowledge that that just like residences were caught in a really tough situation, some of the smaller propane companies and other propane companies found themselves in a financial situation which was very difficult when prices went through the roof. That is between the being piped to Minnesota and then in the distribution, the marketing to from the terminal to the home. So I think where I come out is to say we would agree. I think it's, again, all hands on deck where we all need to be. Obviously, we came to think and support this bill, but there are these larger issues, and I think we all need to be working together, whether it's pipelines, it's suppliers, it's the marketers, distributors, building capacity, working with the companies that are doing that in a very productive way so that we can incentivize, we can do whatever we can to maximize and solve the problem.
Thank you, Commissioner. Follow-up, Senator Weber, and then we have Roger Leiter and Court Holton on deck here to come on up. So, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And certainly in follow-up to what you said, Commissioner, you know, I think, too, that I don't deny that there are problems out there, and that I think what we need to do is vigorously, in those situations where there was actual price gouging and that type of thing, we need to take care of it by the means that are in place to take care of that. I don't think that we have to overburden an entire industry with the results of the actions of those few, and that's why I think we need to be very careful as we move forward here. And don't actually, as the old saying goes, throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Thank you, Senator Weber. Any other questions for Ms. Marshall or for Commissioner Rothman before we bring up Roger Leiter? Senator Sieben, and then it looked like, I think, Senator Rosen, and then Senator Benson. How about we do in that order? Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Rothman, I'm just looking over, and I apologize that I came in late. I was in a different committee. I'm looking over this master agreement between Feral Gas that it looks like, I don't know if you distributed or the author did, or Pam Marshall did. Thank you, Senator Rosen. The second to last quotation says that in the event that we determine, this is meaning Feral Gas, in our sole discretion, provide a refund for propane remaining in the tank, refund will be applicable only to propane that we resell, and the refund shall be based on the lower of the price at which you purchased the propane, at the lower of the price at which you purchased it, or the current market price. I'm wondering if that seems to be a real imbalance that consumers are signing off on there, and I'm wondering if I'm correct in thinking that this seems a little egregious, And if so, is there anything in your legislation that will address that?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, this, Senator Seban, this is the first time I've actually seen this document, so I'd be speaking off the cuff in a way. So I, first of all, would defer to, you know, Feral Gas to explain this. But second of all, would have to agree with you on a first read that if for some reason, I guess the question for me is why wouldn't the consumer get the benefit of the higher price? But you know, if they're being, if they're able to supply additional propane.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner Rothman. I believe Ms. Marshall has input on that. So, Ms. Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Seaman, I'm glad they have the opportunity to do this because this, those are quotes from this master agreement. This is Feral Gas's master agreement. And basically, it also says that if you don't want to accept the terms that are in here, let us know within 30 days and we won't deliver you any propane. There's lots of different terms like and conditions like that, and I also understand that those contract terms change when, as we saw this winter, when supply constraints change. But it also speaks to, I mean, the quote that you read is exactly part of the problem that the industry does tack on additional fees and prices associated with propane that have nothing to do with the actual cost of the propane itself. And so sort of back to the questions that were talked about earlier, the Section 7 of the bill limits the extent to which some, not all, of those fees associated with delivering propane are limited. You know, within the heating season, no, you can't charge low-income people for buying only a minimal amount of fuel because that's the only amount of fuel that they can afford. You can't charge people if they don't use enough propane. So there are not nothing in here says you can't charge for the gas that it cost you to drive your truck to their tank to fill it up. And so I would hate to leave you with the impression that every fee that the business needs to recover some of their expenses are disallowed under this bill because it's not true. It's more of the egregious practices that are addressed.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Senator Seaman, follow-up or we're good? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Rothman, I guess I was just a little more curious about the Cochin pipeline. Number one, can you give an explanation of why they decided to pull out of propane? And how long, I vaguely remember this has been around for a while, and I just need a little more clarity about if there's some stakeholder groups that are being planned to address this, to get this, because we're going to have the same situation again if we're just relying on trucks and rail and some storage capacity. So we need to get a better system for this. And if you could just give me a little more detail.
Commissioner Rothman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen. I don't remember exactly when it kind of bubbled to the surface that this plant, the Cochin change was going to happen. Clearly became an issue at the time of harvest last year and when we talked about, well, what are the issues out there. In particularly because in December, there was, well, actually in the late November, Kinder Morgan was planning some maintenance to be able to do this. What is this? The Kinder Morgan decided to reverse the flow of the pipeline to be able to bring from the south, bring up what's called diluent, or basically it's a distillate, to be able to deliver that to the Bakken area to be able to thin the oil that's being shipped and by making, I guess, easier to deliver that oil. So it's what's been described to me as a business decision. Probably, I don't know the monetary, you know, business decisions, but my guess and what it's been told to me is that it's better for Kinder Morgan to make more money that way than it would be and has been for its propane delivery. from Canada for propane to Minnesota. So that business decided to reverse the flow of the pipeline for that reason. So, again, the issues are imperative and critical for all of us to be talking about. The governor had a meeting with not just the propane industries in the reception room with some of the legislators. Everybody, you know, as these conversations go, I think we should all be in these discussions. And we included the farming community, the railroad community, the trucking community, the stakeholders who are impacted by this, folks like Dooley's, who are in the process now of taking that terminal, reconfiguring it with rail and storage capacity issues. CHS is looking at increasing, as you may know, its capacity, costs, and things like that. And there's some proposals and initiatives that they have that people should really be, that's important for everybody to take a look at those. I think having the conversations with alternatives to being a supply. Let me just give it kind of in stark terms. On the back of an envelope, you can write these, you can do these numbers, but the 40% translates into per gallon over 200 million gallons of propane when we use the maximum. If you go back over the last 10 years, it's a substantial amount of propane. And again, that's what would be needed. Then, of course, in all of this, let me just talk about the economics a little bit. There's decision points. At what point does a farmer build more capacity? Who bears the cost, and how does it get paid for? And all of those decisions, we all need to be thinking about that, plus the residential and storage capacity issues.
So Mr. Chair. Senator Rosen.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Commissioner Rothman, I would assume there are meetings that are going to be ongoing to have a strategic outline of plan of action ongoing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, the governor's had one was basically what happened in December. Why are we in this situation? Talked about doing just that, having the industry continue to have that dialogue, and suggested everybody do that. That was kind of the takeaway. The next meeting was during the propane crisis in January, focused on the emergency situation. How can we get propane supply, and what are the problems and issues? And identifying this as an intermediate. The next conversation that had a lot of the stakeholders in the same room was one that I participated in, with Senator Franken. There isn't a plan. Nobody has really a schedule. It's on my mind to make sure we have one perhaps every month or something, where we all get in the same room and say, okay, where is everybody? What's going on, and what are we doing to work on this?
Thank you.
But there's nobody that's, you know, there's no focal point. There's no master plan in terms of the timeline on what all those solutions are.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Rosen, we're good. Senator Benson, and then Senator Osmick, and how are we doing on time, folks? There, we got two more folks to bring up as well that are in deck. So go ahead, Senator Benson.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Rothman. With regard to the pipeline, they're pretty regulated. Can businesses just switch what they do without going through any sort of regulatory review? Or I mean, how long was this in the pipeline? Sorry, bad use of words. How long was this in process?
I'm here till Tuesday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How long was this in process? Because it seems like it shouldn't have been a big surprise, and we kind of got caught off guard. So what are we, in addition to what Senator Rosen was talking about, solving the problem before we get to harvest season and heating season, is there somebody taking a big view of this, so that when the feds start changing things, Bakken oil field is obviously having an impact on us? I feel like we missed something, but I do want to thank the commissioner for bringing up Dooley's Petroleum. They are from Murdoch, just like the commissioner of agriculture and myself. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't know the specific answer to your question because the state does not regulate the Cochin pipeline. It's a federally regulated pipeline. I don't know when, if there were filings and when those would have happened. So that's really a question for Kinder Morgan or for the propane industry to know. It did come up on our radar screen, but not as a here's what's happening. And you know, because of the unregulated nature from the state's perspective, it's something we had a chance to monitor, but we didn't have. It wasn't our regulatory responsibility for it.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Rothman. And that's a good segue. Speaking of propane, we have Roger Leiter and Court Holton. Come on down. Welcome. And please state your name for the record and who's... Who's going to go first? Should we flip a coin here?
I think it's me.
All right. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, I'm Roger Leiter, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Propane Association, and I'm very proud to be here today representing the propane industry. As Commissioner Rothman and others have already laid out, we've went through an extraordinary year. As a matter of fact, it's been a historic national propane event. We came through a very cold, wet spring, late planting, late harvest, very cold, wet October, which caused, for our industry, a somewhat unexpected. We planned on an increase in crop drying, but not a fourfold increase in crop drying. So those things all lended itself to something that is very, very difficult to manage as we work our way through that. In late November, as crop drying was ending, we entered into winter and something new term this year, polar vortex. And it keeps coming and it keeps coming. And we've had it, and I think we've had a couple days, 4 days above 30 degrees in the last 2.5 months, 3 months now. So we've went through a lot of cold weather. The propane crisis has involved 39 states in DOT, or Department of Transportation, hours of service exemptions. Many of those are still in place. Many parts of the country are going through worst-case scenarios than we are right now. The state of Pennsylvania and Ohio are a couple of them that I can come to mind. We are way above the normal heating degree days for a year. And, you know, as I said, I'm very proud of what the industry has done. I want to take you just a little picture, and you may have something in your handouts about this, about the where we're at. But we're 175% of last year's volume, so almost double, closing in on double. That didn't include February. That was just through January, where we were a year ago. And put that in numbers, that's an extra 125 million gallons of propane that the industry brought into the state, delivered to all the homes, farms, and businesses that are out there. To kind of take a look at that, that's 12,500 semi-loads. That's 37,500 individual small truckloads that goes out to the homes and farms. And they made somewhere in the neighborhood of 370,000 additional individual stops at homes, farms, and businesses. So the industry has done what I consider yeoman's work. The drivers, those people have been out there day and night. They're wading in snow up to their waist. And just talked to a company in Duluth, Minnesota yesterday. And their drivers have been on 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, since the second week of December. They got off Christmas with the caveat you have to work the weekend, and same with New Year's. So those people have worked hard. The managers of those companies have found ways to bring in product when product wasn't available. That meant going to Kansas. That meant going to Iowa. Nobody likes to go to Iowa. He's going to Nebraska.
Ouch. We're going to talk. We're going to talk.
And so, you know,
I did like you before you
started. Sorry.
You're good. That was funny.
I grew up in Iowa, Mr. Chair. I take...
Thank you, Senator Brown. That's good. Go ahead.
We've had trucks that go all the way down to Texas. The governor's working with us on the hours of service exemption was absolutely a must and a key to give the drivers of propane vehicles an hours of service exemption. oftentimes, these drivers were waiting in line 6, 8, 9, 10 hours in line just to pick up a load and bring it back. Normally, under normal conditions, they can haul 3 loads a day. They're lucky if they can haul one. So it really stressed our system out completely. The customer service reps who have taken calls from everybody in the industry wanting deliveries and scheduling those deliveries have done a fantastic job. And the managers also managing the balance between doing this production, getting product out there, and making sure that the public and the employees are safe. They have done a fantastic job. And as I say, I'm exceedingly proud of them. Propane levels in the upper Midwest did drop to extremely low levels, caused by the fact that the entire country was cold. Monday morning, I checked the weather, and it was 31 below in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, but it was 8 degrees in Dallas, Texas. 8 degrees in Dallas, Texas, when it normally should be in the 50s. They're using propane and drawing on these supplies like we've never seen. So this truly was a historic event that we went through. As I said, the governor's hours of service exemption that he put forward and has carried through along with state or federal hours of service has been critical. The increase of crisis funding for low income from $500 to $1,000 for delivered fuels really helped some people through when the price went high and over $5 at times. And also, working with the other governors to allow our trucks to go to Texas. Texas has some rules that unless you're trained by Texas, you can't come there, apparently, and deliver fuel. So they waived those rules, and the governor of Texas said, I know you'd do that for me if I needed something. I don't know what we're going to have up here he wants, maybe lutefisk, but we'll see what happens. So moving on to that, you know, we did a lot of things. We've talked about future supply, and it's been brought up. This year's production, the industry produced 1.5 billion more gallons than it did last year, but we exported 1.8 billion more gallons. So we're increasing our exports, we're increasing our productions. By the year 2025, the production of propane in the United States will double what it is today, and we will have 200% of the availability of propane than is needed. So exports, well, maybe needs to be managed in some way, shape, and form, are very, very pivotal in ensuring that we have long-term propane for the United States. And that's a key part. It's been asked, what are Minnesota propane marketers doing to change and make sure this doesn't happen again? Propane marketers will continue to offer money-saving options to consumers, such as pre-buy and pre-purchase programs. The marketers will encourage farmers and grain elevators to give early notice that they need product. And a caveat onto that is my office on October 10th, I had a propane supplier call me and said, I have 8 rail cars full of propane and nobody wants them. That's the 10th of October. 15 days later, we were asking for an hours of service emergency because we couldn't get enough propane. So something was a disconnect and a capture. We need to work on that with those other groups to ensure that we communicate much better in the future. Many marketers will continue to diversify their supply. Some marketers got caught this year because they bought product from a singular place, and that singular supplier maybe wasn't always able to supply. Most of those are going to diversify so they have different modes of delivery and supply. Marketers are going to work to develop a year-round usage of propane. Selling more propane in Minnesota is part of the answer to having better supply and distribution. In yesterday's news, UPS just bought 1,000 propane-powered vehicles for use in Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. Propane-powered vehicles and year-round usage brings in the infrastructure that we need to ensure that propane supply is always here. Minnesota marketers and suppliers are investing in added storage and delivery infrastructure. That was asked, you know, one of those things that we're looking at. Senate Harvest States in Rockville, Minnesota, has worked with Winter Propane in that city, and they have just increased the storage by double, going up to almost 1 million gallons of storage and doubling their rail capacity. They have tripled their capacity of supply in Glenwood, Minnesota, and adding rail. yes, we're going to have a pipeline that's going to go away, but people are stepping up and making some changes. The normal terminal for propane in Benson, Minnesota, which serves a lot of propane for the state, is being converted to a rail facility. Can rail keep up? Can it do it all? No. There's going to be other alternatives. The Enterprise Pipeline, which currently brings product up from the southern part of the United States out of Kansas, this year did more propane than it's ever done before. In a normal year, that will help cut into that 40% that we now got off the other pipeline. Okay. We're going to see that we're going to have a good supply of propane. If the exact same scenario happened that we had this year, would we be struggling next year? Yeah, probably. We would be struggling, but we'd still be able to make it.
Mr. Leiter, I'm looking at the time, and we have a number of bills that are coming up as well. So if you could get us so we can get to Mr. Holton within 30
really
and a
quick.
Half seconds, I would appreciate that.
Within a couple minutes here. Mr. Chairman, what can consumers do? We ask them to continue to take advantage of all the programs that are available, pre-buy, budget payment plans, pre-fill plans, and price cap plans. Become a scheduled delivery customer. Help the propane marketer fill their containers in summertime when they can bring more product in at a lower price. Upgrade to more efficient appliances and have a home energy audit to understand, you know, that they can use less fuel. What can the state do? Incentivize rural Minnesotans to install energy efficient appliances. Incentivize propane marketers to add more storage and infrastructure. Work with railroad personnel to make propane and heating fuels a priority in the winter on the railroads. And one other piece that we've talked about is forward funding a portion of the LIHEAP program in August. I propose a $15 million forward funding for propane and fuel oil, for that matter, in August and September. LIHEAP funds do not come to the state until nearly November most years. By borrowing and forward funding that, we can buy the gas that the low-income people need in the summertime, fill their tanks, have them taken care of, and pay that money back when the LIHEAP funds come in November. I don't know how the mechanism would work, but it's an idea that I think is worth looking at. As far as this bill that has been before you, it will do nothing. It will not correct the supply and pricing issues that we experienced by the propane marketers and consumers this past year. It will hurt propane marketers' opportunities to secure operating loans. They will be required to deliver fuel at high credit risk customers with minimal partial payments and low probability of ever collecting outstanding accounts. They will provide low-income users with fewer energy choices, as marketers will be forced to tighten their credit requirements for service eligibility. It will raise the cost of propane to all users, all markets, and there will be a need for extra clerical staff, credit staff, as well as budgets for large increases for bad debt. To our knowledge, no one receiving LIHEAP funds had to leave their home for the lack of fuel delivery or refusal from a propane company to deliver fuel. And these are things that I've looked at and talked to the people at the Energy Assistance Agency and at local CAP agencies and saying, has anyone had to move out of their home? And they've said no. So I look at this and I turn around and say that I'm still very, very proud of what this industry has accomplished this year and what we have done. I think we can work with people to make some changes to this bill and alter it and make it something that can help protect some people for contracts and still protect the propane industry.
Thank you, Mr. Leiter. Mr. Colton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Court Holton. I'm speaking for the propane industry in Minnesota. Did you say you've got more bills to hear in this hearing, Mr.
Chair? We do.
Okay. I'm going to go generic then and get through this as fast as possible.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Just a couple of points that I want to make. Some people think that this bill in front of you is something new that emerged from the crisis that we had this year. That is not true. This bill has been around for 10, 12 years. We've been fighting. I have been at countless meetings. And one senator used the word vilify, and the commissioner said, well, I haven't vilified anybody. But as you embrace this, you pick up the history. And I've been at dozens of meetings watching these rural businesses being bashed by people who hate one company. Maybe they hate two companies. I'm not sure. But there's two companies that are multi-state here. And the rest of them are all small rural businesses. And you also heard reference to stories, and I've been running these down for 10 years. They always disappear. Bad stories. And then you heard the commissioner who was hands-on, who actually had real first-hand information, saying everything he said about those situations was good. The rural propane companies are really upset with this. This is like the 12th year of this bill, that this comes after we got through this incredible crisis where people worked and worked under horrible conditions, and we took care of every situation. This bill does not. This bill will cause us to have to finance low-income purchases. There'll be greater debt, accounts receivable, write-offs, and register with the department for some reason, give up proprietary information, private data. All this is going to do is raise everybody's propane costs in rural America. I was around when we ran the milk farmers out of business, and you know I don't think we're any better off. I was around when we ran the poultry farmers out of business, and we could no longer buy eggs from Mavis, which is just outside of town. I think we were better off then than we are today. I could get more specific, but I know you got other bills to hear, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Colton. Thank you, Mr. Leiter. One question from Senator Osmick.
Actually, going to be two. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, if you want to export all the lutefisk out of Minnesota, feel free to do so. Married to a Scandinavian girl, I'm happy to get that stuff out of here. Two questions. One is in reference to what Senator Sieben brought up. There's a comment in here about at the very end of the Feral Gas Master Agreement, it talks about returning and doing refunds, and I'd like you to maybe explain a little bit about that. My understanding would be that if you are taking back product, that there is an inherent cost in returning that product. There's labor to go out and get it. There's gas that goes into the truck to go get it. There's labor that has to take the gas out of the tank, as well as maybe even pick up the tank and move it. Can you provide more information regarding that particular provision, or in general what the industry does and why you would have that type of a provision?
Is Mr. Holton or Mr. Leiter?
I'll take either one that wants to answer it.
Sounds good, Senator. Looks like Mr. Leiter.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmond, you're absolutely correct that there are fees and there are expenses that are incurred to do those types of things. By rule, we cannot move a propane container down the road with more than 5% of product inside that container. So in order for us to pick up a tank at a customer location, we must send another truck out, pump the tank out, then send a truck out to pick up the container and move it to another location. Those pump outs are not, their tanks are not set up, they're designed to put gas in, not easy to take gas back out of them. And so for that reason, we end up with a process that takes some time. So it can take 3 to 4 hours of man hours, time, and distribution. We also looked at a couple, as we start running our trucks around on the road, we just did a bobtail study, and it costs about $4.24 a mile to operate a truck and driver that's hauling propane out there. So it's costly to do that.
Senator Osmond, got a follow-up, and then go to Senator Sieben.
Thank you. Just and a follow-up talking about, on April 1st, we have this thing called warehousing tax that's coming into play. And as right now, that's coming in. There's nothing that's stopping it right now. What is that going to do? You talked about increased capacity, that you're going to have more tanks. these storage locations, when we slap it with a sales tax, what's that going to do to the cost of propane as it exists today, assuming the tax goes into play, as well as what's that going to do, you know, whether it's LIHEAP or not, that's going to act, wouldn't that actually cost us more per gallon of propane and actually drain this amount, talking about tanks, drain the account money faster and faster because of this warehousing tax?
Mr. Colton or Mr. Leiter?
It looks like me. Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Leiter.
Senator, yes, it would. If this warehouse tax stays in place, my understanding is that would apply to bulk storage of propane either at terminals or at the customer location. If that is the case, then we will have a recurring tax that will be paid, and all that gets tacked on to the cost of product.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Osmick. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, if we want to talk about this particular clause, I'm just curious if that's the only charge that the customers are being charged for the pickup of their excess propane, then I think that sounds very reasonable. So I'm assuming that there are no other charges that they're charged that take into account those expenses then?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben.
Mr. Leiter.
It is difficult to put that on any one company. Every single company, we have 180 different propane companies in the state of Minnesota. Each county has at least 3 propane companies serving them. Some have 10. And every one of them has a different policy, different way of doing that. Some charge a fee, some charge a per gallon fee. It's all done in different ways, different mechanisms, whatever they have decided to decreed works for them.
Thank you.
Sounds like we need some regulation.
No other questions? I don't think we have any other testifiers. Oh, sorry. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. maybe Ms. Marshall can answer this question, a two-part question. One is this master agreement, Ferrellgas, I read through it, and it's, pretty eyebrow-raising, if not hair-raising. I'm wondering how common some of these provisions are among the various companies.
Ms. Marshall?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, the exact language of the contracts will vary widely by companies. I think there's a couple of different things to keep in mind here. One, those agreements are not necessarily readily available. So, for example, if you go to a company's website, you may not see those. You may have to call the companies to ask for a contract. Not all of them are as hefty. The ones I've found are quite as hefty as this one. But many of the additional fees will be either laid out in a master agreement or in a tank lease agreement, and those would include fees for minimum delivery and some of the other things we've talked about. Many times when we're talking about pumping out the tank, there will be a fee for tank removal, but then there'll be an hourly rate for other labor associated with doing that. But they do vary. What doesn't seem to vary is that there are in almost every instance that we've found, there will be fees associated with those minimal deliveries and minimal volume requirements.
Thanks.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Mr. Holton stated that if some of the provisions in the Dahl bill were adopted, that it would drive up the costs of propane for everyone. I'm guessing, though, that the goal of the Dahl bill, maybe Senator Dahl can answer this as well, is to create a little more opportunity for customers, particularly customers without a lot of leverage in the market, to have more leverage, more ability to choose among providers, create a little more competition. I mean, I think that's part of what we've been facing with this cold weather issue is folks are captive. Then they are, Senator Brown, I respect you, but I think that a lot of propane customers are captured and are operating in a very monopolistic type environment. Would it be plausible to think that maybe with the introduction of some more leverage on the part of the customers in the market, that would beget some competition, that prices might come down for propane?
Mr. Holton.
Or at least there be some marketplace dynamics more at play that aren't there now?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Holton.
Senator Nibble, the cost increases here are going to be largely the administrative nightmare at the back end of the bill and the taking on of the financing of low-income purchases. That's going to be that will actually attract more of that activity. That's what will drive the prices higher. I don't think this bill really has anything to do with competition, but I will say, ironically, since Pam is sitting next to me, that if we succeed in driving all of the little companies out of the state, her hated villain will be the last man standing.
Senator Dibble?
Well, I'd like Ms. Marshall and Senator Dahl to respond to my question.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. Ms. Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble. And again, remember, this bill applies to those that are doing over $200,000 worth of LIHEAP type dollars, so it's not going to affect the smaller folks. I can comment a little bit, maybe right before you vote on some of the other, just a few other things before about the bill, but I'll let Ms. Marshall talk.
Ms. Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who my hated villain is, but that aside, I don't think that we're talking about companies or that this bill, it's an accurate description to call it financing the purchases of low-income customers. We're basically asking companies that are multimillion-dollar companies, some of which are publicly traded companies, many of whom end up on that top 10 list of receiving LIHEAP funds, operate in 50 states, have over 1 million customers, in one case 2 million customers. We are simply asking that the companies allow them to pay for propane, particularly given the prices that we're facing now, over time and on a budget plan. They do that for other customers. We're asking them to, you know, change the credit practices, our internal policies, such that more people can be a part of those payment arrangements. And if that's described as financing low-income people's purchases, then I guess they are financing everybody who's on a budget payment plan now who is not low-income.
Senator Dibble, thank you. Senator Osmick.
Just briefly, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator Dahl, we do have the warehouse tax that's coming into play, and have you considered adding in a provision to your bill that might make the customers that are into this program exempt from sales tax? Because the average residential customer at $3 a gallon, assuming $3 a gallon of propane, is going to see a 20-cent per gallon increase on April 1st of propane. That equates to $20 on every 100 gallons. To make our money in the LIHEAP program go further and stretch further, is that something you might want to consider when you move on with this? I'm just offering it maybe as a suggestion, but certainly we want to stretch our dollar as far as we can, and the rest of the people are going to get nailed for $20 on every 100 gallons. I think it'd be a good idea for you to consider adding that as a clause in here, if you might think about it.
So Senator Osmick, just I started feeling like we were in the tax committee there for a second, and Senator Dahl, no, thank you. So if there are no other comments, questions, or concerns, I think Senator Sieben moves to Senate File 2164, residential propane customer sales and service terms in the discontinue, recommended to pass and go to the Commerce Committee with amendments. Did you want to say something?
I wanted to ask what the track of this bill was.
Thank you. Yep. It's nice to have Barb sitting next to me. It's going to Commerce, so those folks in Commerce. So the motion's in front of everybody. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Thank you. 2164 is passed and moved on to Commerce with amendments. Next up is Senate File 2193. Members, we're taking off Senate File 2289. That one is not being heard today, but we're going to go to Senate File 2193, Senator Scalzi. Pollution Control Agency, Regulatory Efficiency Improvements, looks like state and local or jobs, ag, and rural development with amendments seems to be the pathway on this one. So, and it looks like there's a couple of testifiers today. Kirk Kozelka and Tony Quillis is going to be with you with Senator Scalzi. Senator Scalzi?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 2193 is a bill proposed by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. It includes proposals for permitting efficiencies and some duty changes of the agency. Because of the 2011 executive order and permitting efficiency law, the MPCA was directed to improve permitting timelines. And so here to explain the bill is Kirk Kozelka, who's the assistant commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Commissioner Kozelka.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kozelka. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And first off, I'd like to thank Senator Scalzi for introducing the bill on permit timeliness for us. As you know, the legislature, since 2010, along with various stakeholders, have been working on permitting timeliness. And as mentioned in the fact sheet, in 2011, an executive order and permitting efficiency law was passed, setting a 150-day goal. Since that time, the agency has met 97% of its construction permits within that 150-day goal. Those are the permits for new facilities or expanded facilities, the ones that drive economic development, produce jobs and products in the state. In addition to the changes passed by the legislature, there have been additional work done on the administration level through process improvements, education, and our strong history of continuous improvement to continue to drive towards that goal of 150 days for the agency. I think just to go through the bill, it might be quicker if we work off the fact sheet that we have, and I will then reference the individual pieces in the bill since they are spread around. This is a bill that affects not only PCA but also the DNR, and the first thing that we are proposing is changing that tiered goal for environmental for permit timeliness, keeping the 150-day goal for those larger permits, those that require public comments or individual actions, but creating a much shorter goal for those that don't. Those are our construction stormwater permits and some of our air registration permits for body shops and the like. So those changes are made in Section 2 for the DNR of the bill and Section 6 for the MPCA. The next item is creating 10-year non-federal permits. The legislature over the last couple years have passed a number of times. For instance, landfills now have a 10-year permit, and so do feedlots. What we'd like to do that is expand that to all solid waste facilities, so composting and transfer stations would be on a 10-year cycle. The same with certain state water permits. These would be, for instance, cluster systems for wastewater treatment. What this does is provides a benefit to those businesses or permitting holders because they no longer have to put together the renewal application, and that includes the time that they spend on that, in addition to agency filing fees, which they would be able to save. The next item, that was on Section 4 and 12 of the bill. The next two items are interlinked, and this is for allowing for increased flexibility in helping expedited process for permits and environmental review and assistance to businesses that need it. Currently, the MPCA has a expedited permit process where a business could come in and if they would like to move their permit along faster than the current resources for the agency has, we can use state employees overtime, or in some cases we can contract out to other contractors and consultants to help us with that effort. What the bill proposes in Section 3 is giving this ability to DNR, and in Section 7 also increasing the flexibility for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency so that at times we can use regular staff hours also. And an example where we would use this is when we get a new industry that comes in and is looking to strike while the iron's hot, and they may want to move their permits along much quicker than being done. An example in the past is ethanol industry. It came in, a group of facilities all at the same time. They wanted to move forward, get the permits, and abide by the environmental protections and regulations in the state, but they wanted to move in a way that they could get their business up and running. This would allow for the agency to staff up when those times come and then staff back down. Instead of passing that additional cost to all permittees, it would be those who are asking for the additional service. And then in Section 11 of the bill, we also make this change for the Minnesota Business First Stop, which is headed up by DEED and is a collection of state agencies to help businesses come into the door, get financial assistance, help with the regulatory programs, and move forward quickly. The next item is Section 5 of the bill, and then we're on the second page of the fact sheet, and that deals with the statutory authority for water quality training. As we know that pollution comes from a number of different sources, and as we continue to move forward, the cost for removing pollution from water discharges and wastewater plants becomes more expensive. So what we'd like to do is provide flexibility to permit holders so that they can trade back and forth to make sure we get the level of environmental protection we do at the lowest possible cost. An example of this is the Minnesota River Basin, where the community of Sacred Heart had struck a deal with the city of Mankato, and they were able to, for $400 a year, meet their phosphorus reductions through the city of Mankato, which could do it much at a lower cost than the city of Sacred Heart having to go forward and building and adding these to their wastewater facilities. This is a way we get the same, if not greater, environmental benefit at a lower cost for various parties. Currently, the language in statute limits this to just nutrients and certain times that we can use this, and we'd like to expand that so this benefit can be provided to others. Section 1 of the bill deals with the Minnesota Data Practices Act. And this goes back to the agency. We're in the midst of a transformation on our environmental databases, whether it's the permitting or environmental data that we're holding. We are now creating an electronic application submission system. So think of TurboTax. You have TurboTax on your computer. You're able to put in your type of data and then save, walk away, go back to it, and continue to work on it. We'd like to offer that same ability to folks working on applications, do their draft information, work on it, start working on their annual reports, save, come back in 25 days or whatnot, and keep working on it. Since it is a state system, technically it is public information. What we'd like to do is make sure that it's private information until they send that information to our program staff. Much like if they had a piece of paper with this information on, it wouldn't become public information until it was handed to us through the mail. The last item on permitting is Section 2 and 6 of the bill. It just deals with the current permitting efficiency report. Currently, it's done twice a year, so with every 180 days, we report on our 150-day goal. Because of that small window, it really doesn't give us a true snapshot of what's going on. And we believe we can get the same information by just reporting it once and being able to look over at 365 days instead. What's been new to this conversation on timeliness is compliance and enforcement. And we do have three other pieces proposing in this bill. Just like permitting, compliance and enforcement seeks to meet those same goals of protecting and improving the environment and enhancing public health. And there are a number of benefits to the public in addition to this. One is also permit timeliness. Many times when a business comes in to do an expansion or make some changes, they may have still a compliance issue that they need to resolve. As an agency, we cannot issue that permit for the expansion until the compliance issue is fixed. So it's beneficial to them to have the enforcement or compliance issue wrapped up in a timely manner. Also, we'd like to change and increase the access to different types of tools for resolving compliance issues and expanding where we could use less time-consuming processes. This means there's less time away from business owners from their business, which they're really interested in their main concern, less time for attorney fees by the business, and also brings closure to issues and helps people get a cleaner record. Many times, these cases, the individual wants to do what's right, get what's done, and move on and clear their name. So what we propose are three things. In Section 8, there are two changes. One is currently the way that it has been interpreted by some that during an investigation, if there are multiple parties during a compliance situation, what is seen is that we can only use an administrative penalty order if it's under $10,000. What we'd like to, and this comes into a case, for example, of asbestos removal, if there's a violation and looking at all the factors, was it willful, what their past history is, what the damage to public health and the environment was, we decide the three parties, the demolition contractor, the removal contractor, and the project manager, should each get a penalty for, say, $6,000. We cannot use this tool, which would help bring compliance within 30 days. Instead, we have to go through a lengthier process. Also, in regards to this, I just want to make it very clear what we're not doing. What we're not doing is changing the maximum amount of that penalties per day per violation. That is in a different section of statute. That's Chapter 115, and that sets our limits for how much a penalty can be done per violation. We're not changing that. What we're changing is once we look at a situation, we find there's a compliance issue, we first look and see what needs to be done to fix it. How do we bring them back into compliance? And then if this is an issue where penalties are appropriate, we look at their history. Was it willful, the damage they've done, the economic benefit may have been gained in the process. And if we decide that this is a situation where the penalty should be $15,000, what we'd like to do is open it up so that they can use an administrative penalty order, which is, again, an easier way for someone to get this remedied, less time away from the business, less time that attorneys are involved, to make it a quicker process to bring back into compliance. And an example of this is in 2010, there was a $20,000 penalty assigned for an unpermitted wastewater discharge processing plant. We had to go through a much longer process involving more attorneys' times and fees and owners away from their business to settle to get this worked out. And a result, it ended up taking 150 days longer than it should. An administrative penalty order currently averages 250 days plus to get resolved, where if we have to use a stipulation agreement, it's up in the range of 850 days to get a resolution from discovery to closure of the issue. The final item on the fact sheet is dealing with a similar tool making available to the agency's field citations for septic system violations. And this would be for businesses only. When looking at septic system violations, we see a similar pattern. We see a situation arise where there are at the same dollar amounts for the same type of offenses. So instead of having to work up agreements each time for administrative penalty order, we would like to suggest using field citations that match what's outlined in statute in Section 9 and 10, so that's a very distinct amount of money, and it would not be more than what we're doing now for these type of cases, but there's very certainty we get it done with and resolved quickly. Last item in the author's amendments, there is a provisions on lines 1.3 to 1.23 dealing with tank fees. And what we're doing there is trying to improve the process. It's currently a very burdensome process. There's a lot of going back and forth between the three parties involved, the counties, MPCA, and installers, and we'd like to streamline that to make it easier for this to be administered. With that, Chair and committee members, I'll wrap up my testimony and be available for any questions.
Senator Scalzi, the A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move that to get it in the bill into the shape that I would like. This is the first stop for this bill.
Scalzi moves the A1 amendments. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Questions from the committee? There was anybody else going to testify on the bill? It's Mr. Lewis.
Madam Chair, member, or Madam Chair, I am sorry, Mr. Chairman, as all of us are, I am scurrying between committees, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. It's good to see you this afternoon. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for the time today to comment on Senator Scalzi's proposal, Senate File 2193. I want to thank Senator Scalzi and Mr. Kudelka for involving the Chamber of Commerce in the discussions as this bill moves forward. We are supportive of a number of provisions in this and have questions on other provisions, and we will, and I can point those out, but we have been already working towards to answer some of the questions. They're not huge sticking points, but just some questions very quickly on the nutrient trading. Mr. Kadelka and I haven't had a chance to talk about that, but just how that would work mechanically. And then we've reached out to some of our members on the administrative penalty orders, and we'll be keep working through that. There's a number of stops that this bill is going to make along the way. But our members, Mr. Chairman, this continues on 3 years ago, if you remember, on a bipartisan basis. Our members have identified environmental permitting and environmental review as an issue area that is very important to them, to businesses in this state, whether they locate or expand here. One of the things they look at besides taxes and workforce and energy costs is environmental permitting. And so we look forward to working with the Dayton administration and Senator Scalzi as we move forward through this. I know Governor Dayton in his mining cabinet meetings up north, he's also identified in his unsession agenda that taking this permitting 150-day goal that we put in 3 years ago and working it to 90 days, we think is a good starting point and opening offer. We might have a little bit of a difference on how we define those tiers, and we've had some preliminary discussions on that with the agencies and whether you call those out particularly or and I want to thank Mr. Kadelka and the agency and Senator Scalzi for the A1 amendment. It helps move us that way a little bit more. And we'll continue to have those discussions, Mr. Chairman. But I wanted to just thank you for the time and point out that we're very supportive of the tiered permitting, the expedited permitting, and, you know, updating the, as Mr. Kadelka mentioned, the 10 years on the SDS permits. So I just wanted to get that on there on the record, Mr. Chairman, and we will keep working with the author and the agency as we move forward. But we think it is a good starting point for us to move forward in the environmental permitting arena.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Are there questions or comments from the committee? And is there anybody else in the audience who wish to speak to the bill? Is there further discussion on the bill? Senator Scalzi, you're Commissioner Kadelka, is this going to ag next or state and local or where?
It's going to ag next, I believe. So I would move then that Senate File 2193 as amended be approved and passed to the Committee on Ag.
Senator Scalzi moves Senate File 2193 as amended to be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And I believe the Fish and Wildlife Subcommittee is meeting 3 p.m. in this room, across the hall, in room 112. Senator Schmitz, yeah. The subcommittee meets at 3 o'clock in room 112. Is there no further business for the committee? This meeting is adjourned. As long as it